Hello.
Hey, is this Michael?
Hi, how are you?
Good. This is Jake from the MMA Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with us. We both really look up to what you've done.
I just let me go outside and I get a bit more quiet in here. How long are you guys waiting for me to be?
Going now. I mean, however long is good for you, whether you know you want to stay on for 10 minutes or half an hour. It's all up to you, man.
Cool. Let's play by ear. See how we go.
All right. It sounds good. How is your Halloween going so far?
Going well. Looking forward to heading out onto the town tonight here in Vegas and seeing the freaks out and about.
Yeah. I live in Chicago, actually, and just going home from work, I was walking by tons of people with face paint and costumes on. It was pretty entertaining. I had a few laughs. You dressing up as anything or just going as Michael Schiavello?
No, I bought just a little mask to wear. It's some old dude with a cigar hanging out of his mouth and a funky moustache. So should be a bit of fun. It covers my face so I can mock people, and then no one recognizes who I am. So it's sort of a double benefit.
Nice. Yeah, I wanted to ask, you know, we know you host your own show called The Voice Versus on HDNet, along with, obviously, a bunch of live cards. Take us through the normal day of in the life of Michael Schiavello.
A normal day is pretty much, if I'm sort of haven't got any shows on or anything, I'm basically just chilling out, hanging with my wife. We're here in Vegas, so weather's always good. We're heading out and about, or we're just chilling at home. And, it comes closer to a show. Obviously, there's a lot of travel involved. We're always heading off to different cities every weekend. And, like to spend a bit of time resting in the hotel room and adjusting to the climate, the time zone that I'm in, and making sure that all my research gets done. And, it's busy the day before the fights. We'll go to the weigh-ins, and then we'll meet the fighters afterwards and do our fighter interviews that we always like to do. So we sit down with all the main card fighters for about 5 minutes each and ask them some pertinent questions to get our research details all down pat. We'll ask them how their training went and how long their camp was and, their thoughts on their opponent and injuries coming in. We'll ask them to be very specific about their game plan for the fight, and we do reassure them that whatever they say sort of stays between us and doesn't get told to their opponent. It's just the television use on the night of the fight. And then, the day of a fight, I like to get up and have a nice breakfast to keep me going for most of the day. Then I'll finish up all my fight notes in the afternoon and have a nice shower, shave, and change up. And we usually get to the venue about 2 hours before the live show starts, and it gives us enough time to just relax and get a feel for the venue, settle in, get a drink, go get makeup done, do any sort of final bit preparations, do microphone tests and lighting tests and record intros if we're doing any pre-records and record interviews if we're doing any pre-records that aren't live, and then sort of just settle into the fights and have a lot of fun with them. Enjoy the 2 or 3 hours that we're on air and basically just have a good time and be informative and entertaining. And, the main aspect we try and do is to always be educational for our viewers, informative, thoroughly researched, but also highly entertaining. And, then it's head back home, chill out for a few days, wash, rinse, and repeat all over again.
Nice. That's great. It's really obvious you're having an awesome time while you commentate on fights, and you were actually a commentator for other sports before you got wrapped up into the MMA landscape. You know, and it's a question we ask most fighters, and it applies to yourself as well. What originally got you hooked onto the sport of mixed martial arts and make it, your career path?
Forced into MMA a little bit. Originally, my interest was in kickboxing. I first attended my first ever kickboxing event, which was my first ever fight event, almost 20 years ago, December 6, 1992. It was the great Dennis Alexio versus Stan the Man Longinidis for the World Heavyweight Championship in Melbourne. I was 17 years old at the time, and I covered it for a local radio station and a couple of local newspapers. And I guess that night there was 8,000 people there. It was the biggest kickboxing crowd they'd ever had in Australia, and it was a huge international event, and I just got hooked by all the hype and, the fights that were on and meeting the fighters. And, Dennis Alexio had a great deal to do with that as well. I got to interview him a few days before the fight, and he was such a gentleman. And, You know, I absolutely adored him. He was a larger than life figure to me, who just a few years earlier had starred in a major film opposite Jean-Claude Van Damme in the film Kickboxer. So I really got sort of sucked into it and enjoyed it and loved it, and you know, ended up shortly writing freelancing for a martial arts magazine that I later became the head editor of, and I invented a kickboxing magazine the year later, which is still going today. It's probably the largest kickboxing magazine in the world, still going strong today, and co-invented that in 1993. And then in about 96, I think it was, Australia had its first ever mixed martial arts event. It was called Cage Combat in Sydney. And I'd been doing the local sort of commentary scene there with kickboxing, and got asked by the promoter to commentate mixed martial arts, and didn't know too much about it, but was willing to learn, and you know, had watched the early UFCs and covered the early, you know, even UFC number one, covered it for a magazine, and you know, some of the early stuff that was happening in Japan back then as well. And that was my first foray into mixed martial arts, and after that I was, you know, hooked on MMA, and one thing led to another, and eventually I was getting asked to do more MMA commentary, and eventually getting asked to do commentary over in, you know, Dynamite in Japan, and you know, getting out and about and over there, and then eventually getting recognised by Mark Cuban, the owner of HDNet, now Access TV, and getting approached by Cuban to work for the network. So, yeah, one thing sort of led to another, and it's been a beautiful experience, a lot of hard work, you know, not doing it for much money in the early days, just doing it for the experience to lead to where I am now.
Yeah, that sounds like an amazing journey. This is Chris, by the way, Michael. Pleasure to have you on the show, man. It's an absolute honor for me personally. I've been listening to you for the last, I want to say, 4 years, I think. K1 primarily, and then all these other organizations. So thank you for coming on, sir.
Oh, it's my absolute honor. I missed the K1 days, actually. I was just thinking about that the other day. It's a shame the K1 folded. The K1 that we knew, there's a new K1 organization now, of course, which, you know, it doesn't closely resemble the old great heady days of K1, which I was a part of, and I miss it dearly.
Yeah, and, you know, speaking of the last K1, I watched that last K1 live on HDNet, and it seems like so long ago. That was December 2010, and Alistair Overeem just made complete waves, first guy to ever be a mixed martial arts champion, as well as a K1 champion. Can you kind of walk us through that last experience that you had with K1?
Yeah, well, that was the last, you know, the last event of K1 in its initial incarnation, I suppose. Some could say second incarnation since FEG took over, but really, you know, the first sort of incarnation of K1. It was great to see Alistair, you know, ride to the top and accomplish what he accomplished in a very short time. Just speaks volumes for how good of an all-round fighter that he is. You know, one of the things I used to love about K1 back then is we used to develop storylines a lot. We used to develop, you know, like you would say, wrestling baby faces and heels, the good guys and the bad guys. And what was so interesting was that the year before, we'd sort of put Alistair as the bad guy, and, you know, Bada Hari and Remy Bajewski were the good guys in 2009. And then by 2010, Alistair Overeem had become the good guy, the way we'd formulated the storyline. And, you know, we got everyone glued to it and everyone watching it around the world. And it worked so superbly. And Alistair was, you know, in on it all and so good to work along with us. And, you know, once again, just a real testament to him and his skill set, just how he came in and he dominated a lot of very experienced fighters, you know, the likes of Peter Ertz and Bada Hari and, you know, beating Tyrone Spong and Gokhan Saki and, you know, eventually winning the championship against Peter Ertz there in 2010 with a stunning first-round knockout. It was a pleasure to commentate Alistair and to see his progress from a guy I'd seen, you know, for the first time live in Amsterdam many years earlier, competing in mixed martial arts, who wasn't even looking at, you know, competing in the kickboxing world, to sort of explode onto the scene a few years later and basically within the space of, you know, 2.5-3 years, become the K1 champion, which was just a massive feat.
Not only a massive feat, but just fantastic to watch. That card, like you said, was the last in that iteration of it. And what a great card that was. You had Aerts, you know, rallying back against you know, semi-shill, and then you had Alistair facing up and his former training partner, Tyrone Spong. But moving past that K1 event, I wanted to get your take on K1 Los Angeles and kind of the future of K1. How do you feel about that, and where do you see the event going in the future? I really hope that it makes a glorious return. I just think that someone with a lot of money needs to put a backing into it, and I think it has a lot of appeal here in the States because, it, in my opinion, it's far superior to boxing. How do you feel about that?
Well, K1 has always had the most massive appeal, I think, of any combat sport. I think it has more appeal than mixed martial arts. I think it has more appeal than boxing. Its appeal never had a major backer, a major Western backer behind it before, particularly in America. I think HDNet, you know, now Access TV, formerly HDNet, we did a big part in pushing K1's popularity into the American fight audience, basically before it came on TV, through HDNet. You know, only your hardcores here in America knew about K1, and no one really knew the likes of Masato, Giorgio Petrosian, Andy Sauer, Remy Benjaski, Semi Schultz, Peter Ertz, Bada Hari. You talk about the LA show, and I think, you know, they tried to reinvent it and tried to spur K1 on them again, but the fact of the matter is that they just don't have the same depth of talent that they used to have. All the great fighters that they once had have now gone to the Glory Series, and K1's really scraping the bottom of the barrel as to who are the fighters worthy to wear a K1 crown. And I think, you know, you look at it this year and you look at the final, you know, the final eight or whatever that are going to be competing for the prize. Yeah, sure, you've got Mirko Krokop in there, but besides that, you know, even Mirko these days, you can't call him an A-grade kickboxer. You know, he hasn't kickboxed for a long, long time. I think if you fought any of those guys who were in the 2010 K1 Grand Prix, get his butt handed to him quite easily. You know, it's not the same, and you know, K1's trying to push itself on the Spike TV. I hear rumors that that's not going to happen, that it's not happening at the moment the way that they thought it would be. The reception wasn't overwhelming for the last two events they had. You know, even the last three events that they had, just that the talent's not there, the hype isn't there. I hope it can get back to the heady days, but I just don't know if I see it happening with the current version of K1, how they're doing things.
Definitely, definitely. Michael, you've commented for numerous organizations such as K1, Dream, Sengoku, HDNet Fights, like we just mentioned, called lots of fights, many of them historic, but if you had to put your finger on one fight and call it your favorite, which would it be?
That's a tough one because, as you said, you know, I've commentated so many regional fights here in America on great promotions and the stuff over in Japan like Dynamite and Dream and K1 Max and K1, also doing the Commonwealth Games, doing the Olympic Games in Beijing, which was a huge buzz for me back in 2008. You know, the Peter Ertz versus Semi Schultz match you mentioned earlier, I think will always stand out just because Peter Ertz, for me, personifies what K1 spirit is all about, what true Dutch kickboxing spirit is all about, and you know, overcoming the odds at his age to beat Semi Schultz the way he did will always stick out. So there was a fight back in 2007 at the Budokan, which I always mention as one of my favorites, if not, you know, maybe my favorite of all time, Masato versus Bulacau. It was when Masato was at the sort of coming up to the peak of his powers, and Bulacau was at the peak of his powers, and Masato called out Bulacau to fight him when no one else wanted to. Sell out crowd at the Budokan. It was just a crazy atmosphere and a crazy venue that, you know, the Budokan is historic. One of my favorite places to commentate in it was a place where, you know, the Beatles once played in Japan, where Muhammad Ali fought Antonio Inoki, and to have Masato put on the fight of his life and drop Bulacau in the first round, win over decision against Bulacau, as I said, at the height of his powers, I think that's one that will stay with me forever.
Yeah, that's really awesome. I actually saw you at Titan FC, I believe, in Tampa, Florida. It was kind of cool seeing one of my favorite fighters who'd called some historic matches overseas in my little hometown calling Titan FC. Kind of moving on, your buddy Joe Rogan has said on numerous occasions that although he loves his job, he typically has more fun spectating rather than announcing fights. Do you feel the same way?
You know, it depends. I don't actually get to go to that many fights as a spectator these days. Most of the fights I go to, I'm pretty much there working them. It's still a buzz for me to commentate. I still get a buzz preparing for the shows, meeting all the fighters, walking to that arena every weekend. You know, once the green light goes on and we're live on TV, it's just the ultimate adrenaline dump for me. It's amazing. You know, it's it's weird what adrenaline can do in your body. It's a story that I like to relay. Back in, I might have been like 2008, I suffered glandular fever. I don't know what you guys call that in America. You've got another name for it, but I forget what it is now. Glandular fever.
Panic attack?
It can get... Sorry?
Is that a panic attack, or is that an actual...
No. Oh, there's a name for it. Not mumps. I'm sure it begins with
M. Is it Epstein-Barr?
Sorry?
Epstein-Barr virus? I actually just Googled it.
No. Jeez, it just slips my brain. You know what? This sounds really embarrassing. It's commonly called the kissing disease, because usually you get it from making out with someone, from kissing someone. And it's a disease that, like, it affects the glands, your thyroid gland, the glands around your throat, your neck really swell up. And it can actually lay you out for like 6-7 months, and it just fatigues you, depletes you of energy. It's a horrible thing to experience. But I suffered that at the beginning of about 2008. And I remember a couple of days into having a glandular fever, I had to travel to Japan to do a K1 show. So I remember the long, flight from Australia to Japan is about 10-11 hours, and being on the plane, having glandular fever, and it wasn't a nice feeling, and going to the venue and, wanting just to do nothing but sleep, because that's all you want to do when you've got glandular fever, and especially your throat just playing up on you, which makes it extra hard to commentate. But, the thrill of being live TV and the thrill of seeing my favorite fighters and commentating at K1, for the 4 or 5 hours that the show was, I got this massive adrenaline dump in me, and I didn't feel any of the effects of the glandular fever, while I was commentating. And even after the show had finished, it seemed to me like for the next few days, the glandular fever was gone from my system, and I got it out of me pretty quickly. So just, to give you an example of the type of adrenaline dump you can get from doing something like commentary and something you're so passionate about and enjoy, it's pretty amazing. So, to answer your question, I do enjoy going to live shows. I'm always a fan of fighting. If I wasn't commentating, I'd still watch mixed martial arts. I'd still watch boxing and kickboxing. I even enjoy, traditional karate like Kyokushin karate. I enjoy watching some taekwondo and wrestling and all that sort of stuff. But for me, it's, just so much fun still to be able to commentate.
Yeah, and speaking of adrenaline dumps, Michael, I got one of those when you came on, man. I was just biting my nails like, oh, shit, we got Michael Chevelle on. So I know exactly how you feel. Maybe not on that same level, but, when we watch you commentate, we can really – I can personally really see that you are so into it, because there's been times in the broadcasting table where you and Cepho and Mo or whoever else is there with you are just grabbing each other and jumping up and down. And I can definitely see how it would lead to something like that. It's a crazy experience, man. I definitely see where you're coming from.
I remember the name of what you guys call glandular fever here in America. You call it mono. Mono?
Yeah.
That's it. Mono. Yeah. So I had mono, and that's what the adrenaline dumped out the cure on me. So yeah, mono. Kissing disease is its name.
I'm glad to hear you're all right now. You're a trooper and obviously professional. And you were on the Joe Rogan podcast, one of my favorites ever, because you two are kind of a dream commentating team for me. If I could get both of you guys in for some kind of event, that would be amazing. And when you were on there, you mentioned that you went to Amsterdam with Peter Ayers. He had a cigarette case full of joints, and you mentioned getting kind of blitzed off of a vaporizer. I consider myself a black belt in the cannabis variety, so I was going to ask you if there's any other crazy Peter Ayert stories you have to share with us, when you guys were in Amsterdam.
Well, first of all, I'm far from an expert of smoking. I can't remember the last time I even had a joint. That might have been the last time I had one back to, Peter Ayert's. When in Rome, do what the Romans do, right? So when in Amsterdam and you're getting a tour of the red light district at Peter Ayert's and Ray Cepho and guys like that, then hey, why not take a puff here and a puff there? And, we had many, many crazy adventures over the years that have happened, and there's so many of them that I tend to forget because, it's overload. I remember being chased through the streets in Sapporo, which is in northern Japan, once with Ray Cepho, the height of Ray's popularity. We were walking along the streets looking for a bar to have a drink at about 10 o'clock at night. And, before we knew it, there was like 40 people, 50 people walking behind us. And then it walked, turned into a canter, and a canter turned into a sprint. And we had to actually duck into a karaoke bar and get forced into an elevator and up to the fourth floor with 40 or 50 autograph hunters trying to squeeze their hand through the elevator doors just to touch Ray Cepho. And we had to stay up there for like 3-4 hours singing songs to all these autograph hunters have basically dissipated and gone home. You know, crazy experiences back in 2001 when Mark Hunt won the K1, and, you know, people were running alongside the side of the road next to the fighter's bus. The fighter's bus would stop at the light, and then just, you know, hundreds of fans would clamber towards the bus and try and pass a piece of paper through the window to Mark Hunt to try and get autographs. And, you know, back at the hotel, you know, having to wade through 200-300 people to try and make it from the bus, the valet at the front of the hotel to the front door. And, you know, back in those days when groupies were running wild in K1, and there was not a night you went out to Roppongi, which is like the party capital of Tokyo, or it used to be at least, and you get back to your hotel at 4 or 5 in the morning and there were any number of groupies just hanging in the hotel, you know, waiting to spend a night or a few hours with a K1 fighter or a K1 commentator or anyone to do with K1. Just, you know, these crazy days. And there were always autograph hunters in the lobby of the hotel, and it used to be actually, it was a novelty at first, and it used to become a little bit annoying because, you know, every time you go downstairs for breakfast, there'd be at least 10, 20 guys asking for autographs. And you come back from breakfast, head back to your room, the same 10 or 20 guys ask you for another autograph. Then, you know, 4 hours later, you're heading down for lunch, and boom, 20, 30 guys again asking for autographs. So just crazy, crazy scenes. But it's a lot of fun, and the stuff that memories are made of. And, you know, I'm sure there's many other stories. I just can't recollect them right now.
Well, I really appreciate you just telling us that in itself. That was entertaining as it is. You know, you've definitely got one of the best entertaining commentating styles out there, and you're known for tons of exhilarating one-liners while you're in the moment. I was wondering if we could get a personalized Michael Schiavello one-liner for the MMA podcast. Is there any way we could do that?
You know, the thing with the one-liners is that this is the funny thing, and I hate to shoot you guys down, but it also brings me to another really interesting sort of little tangent, is that often back home, not so much here in the US, but back home in Australia, I've been commentating on Fox Sports for, you know, since 1996 or so. I'll go out to a club or to a bar and someone will recognize me and I'll be like, oh, hey, quickly, say something for me. I'm like, what the hell do you want me to say? Commentate something for me. I'm like, what do you mean commentate something for you? I can just pull a commentary out of my ass and start commentating out of thin air. You know, give me a one-liner. I'm like, oh, it doesn't happen that way. It never has. And I don't know what it is, but it's like, something inside me that doesn't click on until those headphones are on, until the camera's in front of me, until the green light is flashing. And, you know, when I'm away from the camera and away from being on air, I'm just your normal, typical dude. I sort of don't walk around commentating things and don't walk around throwing out one-liners. I'm just probably, you know, a little bit quiet and just sort of sit back and relax. But once the on-air switch goes on, the sort of animal inside comes out. It's like let off the leash type of thing. But it's sort of like my brain doesn't function unless I've got those headphones on and that live camera light on. And then once that's off, so the brain goes into wind down mode. Maybe you guys can relate to it with your podcast. Maybe you experience something similar, or maybe you guys live in a 24/7 world where your brain is operating on your podcast level. But yeah, for me, it's sort of it's weird like that. It's, you know, I'm really quiet and reserved in the fighter interviews and before the show. And, you know, as soon as the light goes on, then just it's like my head opens up and some, call it divine influence, just puts all these sayings inside my head and I just sort of go through my head and come out of my mouth.
No, I completely understand where you're coming from. I consider myself a humorous guy, and when people go make me laugh, I'm just like, well, it doesn't really happen that way. So I absolutely understand where you're coming from. It's more of set and setting, and it has to be an organic experience. But as far as your one-liners,
It was also like, you know, there was a Seinfeld episode once. I remember, I think it was Seinfeld, where a guy is saying to Seinfeld, you're like, you're a comedian, give me a joke. And Seinfeld sort of looks at him and just goes, well, What can I say? Like, what sort of joke? I don't do knock-knock jokes, and I can't just do a joke. But, you know, obviously I could relate to that because when the guy's on stage, he's performing, then the jokes come, you know, quick and easy, and jokes that he's never even done before and ones that he's rehearsed in his head or whatever that may be. But when someone on the street goes, hey, you know, give us a funny line or tell us a joke, you're like, yeah, I'm not that sort of comedian, you know. And you can, you know, you guys can probably relate to that as well. It's like, you know, if someone sort of comes up to you and says, hey, you know what, do a podcast on me right now on the spot. You're like, no, unless we're in our studio and we've got our microphones and our phone lines hooked up and they're all in front of us with our headphones on, we don't really go into podcast mode.
Very true, good sir. I just wanted to say before I pass the reins back to Jake, my favorite one, I can't remember the exact line, but from my recollection, you said, "That dude's taking more of a pounding than Jenna Jameson." Like, that was fantastic to me, man.
Oh, man, the Jenna Jameson line was a funny one. It's actually been mounted more times than Jenna Jameson.
That's what it is. That's it.
Yeah, that was it. It was a Jason High fight on Dream 10. I sort of just pulled that out of nowhere, really. It just happened in my mind that, oh God, he's been mounted so many times. I can think of a porn star's name. Hey, Jenna Jameson sort of came to mind. The funny thing is that she somehow ended up hearing that and then contacted me on Twitter. And we were tweeting each other in private for quite a while, you know, for like a year or so. Always, you know, we'll always miss each other, whichever towns we would travel to. And she's like, "Hey, where are you going to be this weekend? I'm going to be here. Any chance you're here?" And I'm like, "No, you know, I'm in this city. Any chance you're in this other city next weekend?" We were like two ships passing in the night. But, you know, she ended up hearing that line and got quite amused by it as well. Didn't take offense to it at all. So that was quite funny.
Wow. Yeah, I'm talking about your really entertaining commentating style. Your calls of Jason Mayhem Miller walking out were almost as entertaining as the walk-ins on their own. And Jason's been making the news recently for all the wrong reasons. What is your take on his state of mind? You think it's more of a publicity stunt, or do you think there's really something wrong going on with Mayhem?
Look, you know, I've always loved Mayhem. I loved working with him. He's one of the best color commentators I've worked with. We had a natural energy, and I loved the guy. I think, you know, he's always been a lot of fun to hang out with. He's always been very respectful. I think I was maybe one of the few guys that could actually curb his enthusiasm a little bit and rein him in, and, you know, make sure he was focused for every show that we did, whether we did the Dynamite we did together in Japan, the King of the Cage shows we did together, the Voice Versus episode we did together. And for me, it's as a friend and a colleague, it's sad to see the state that, you know, Mayhem has become now. The whole episode of The Church and, you know, other very public episodes of him sort of just going off the rails. I don't know what it is. I don't think it's publicity. I think there's probably some pretty deep set issues that Jason has, whether it's issues to do with medication or lack thereof, whether it's some sort of personal deep set issues that maybe he needs to see a professional over to try and work out where these issues stem from and to try and, you know, get them out of his system. It's a shame to see that such a talented individual, both a talented fighter and a very talented entertainer as well. You know, he was fantastic on Bully Beatdown. He's fantastic in interviews. You can throw him in any situation in front of a camera, and usually he would be gold, but now he's just too much of a risk to be able to do that with live. I just sort of, you know, as a friend especially, I wish him all the best and hope he gets better, because I've always had a lot of fun with Mayhem. He's one of my favorite people in the sport, and, you know, whatever the problem is, I hope he can get to the root of it and get it out of his system.
Yeah, and I think most of us who are MMA fans really like him and kind of feel the same way. And kind of speaking to stick to those Japanese promotions we were talking about, there's a lot of speculation that a certain amount of fights over there that went down were fixed. We actually got a Twitter question or two who wanted to ask you about it. So what percentage of fights you called do you believe were works? And were you ever watching a fight and as the fight ended you came to the conclusion ringside that, wow, this had to have been a worked fight?
You know, I don't think I've ever come to the conclusion that it was a work fight from the get-go. There have been a couple of fights, and I can't mention them specifically off the top of my head, where I've sort of looked at my director or my co-commentator after the fight when we're off air and said, "Hey, you know what, that was a tomato can. That was a gimme. That was a fight that this dude was meant to lose and this dude was meant to win for whatever reason." I've seen instances of tomato cans. I've seen them a lot. I've seen them a lot in kickboxing and Muay Thai, especially when you get these, you know, so-called Muay Thai fighters come out and fight in Australia and they're nothing more than, you know, chefs or taxi drivers who come over and stand up for half a round and then get knocked out and have no fight skills. Now, do you call that a setup fight? Do you call it a rigged fight? Or do you just call it a tomato can getting bashed, which is pretty much what it is? As far as, you know, rigged fights and worked fights, every time I think of a worked fight, I think to myself, well, it's a pre-rehearsed, preordained result that, hey, you're going to do this for this amount of time, then you're going to drop in the first or you're going to drop in the second. No, I don't believe I've ever seen that or any sort of blatant, example of that. But, you know, there's been fights where I've sort of gone, well, that was just a piece of shit fight. You know, that was a tomato can. That was a bum brought in to lose. That was a guy who didn't even try to win and just basically took a fall. That was a weak pussy's way out of a fight. And you'll see a guy feign an injury or get a knockout where it doesn't even look like the punch hit him or the kick hit him. That's a question I can answer saying no, that I've never knowingly participated in a worked fight. But I had seen fights where I thought to myself, okay, this is just a dodgy decision, a hometown decision, or this guy's just a banana or a tomato can taking a fall and coming here for a holiday and an easy paycheck.
Yeah, I actually 100% agree with you. I personally, in my history with watching MMA, have really never seen a fight that I thought was fixed. I mean, I've seen it in boxing. But there's times where you kind of question, why the matchmaking was made. So speaking of matchmaking, I recently read an article about the top 10 fights that were never booked. And some examples that come to mind are Brock versus Fedor or Couture versus Fedor. I found that really intriguing, and I kind of wanted to get your take on, which fight stands out to you that should have happened that never took place either in kickboxing or mixed martial arts?
Very good question. Very, very good question. You know, I think the obvious ones that come to mind are the two you mentioned for mixed martial arts. All of us are forever going to have questions about what Fedor could have done had he been signed by the UFC. Had he fought the likes of Randy in his prime? Had he fought the likes of Brock Lesnar? Had he fought the likes of Alistair Overeem? I think they're the major questions that will always hang over mixed martial arts. What could have been if Fedor Emelianenko had been signed by the UFC? Kickboxing, man, I've got hundreds of them. They might be a little bit old school for some of your listeners, but if your listeners are a bit old school, I'm talking, Stan the Man Longanides versus Dennis Alexio Part 2. To me, that would have been great. The first one lasted only, 6 or 7 seconds when Alexio broke his leg. There were many rumors afterwards they were trying to organize a rematch, but it never happened. For me, that would have been a great one. I would have loved to have seen maybe a Branko Sikatic Alexio rematch. I would have liked to see Alexio versus a Maurice Smith. I would have liked to see, some of the guys come back and fight Rob Carman, in the early days, or Ramon Decker in the early days, or Danny Bill in the early days. Some of the legends, which unfortunately we're never going to see. Petrosian and Masato, I think, is probably in K1 Max. The one that really stands out for me. What would have happened between the two, undoubtedly greatest K1 fighters of all time? Would Masato have had the weapons to beat Petrosian, or would Petrosian have made Masato look as easy as he did basically everyone else in his career? There's a lot of interesting what-if matchups you can throw out there.
What a beautiful breakdown, sir. I'd absolutely agree with you. There's a lot of questions out there. And speaking of questions, before we let you go to enjoy your Halloween and have a good time with your family on the strip. We just had a few more, like yourself. I'm a huge Alistair Overeem fan. He is my number one favorite combat sports fighter of all time. I myself don't follow any other sports besides combat sports. I think it's the epitome of competition. And, I just wanted to ask your take on Alistair. I know this is a very personal question, and I'm not trying to make any ratings here, but I just wanted to really ask you, do you think that he got the shaft with his suspension, or do you think it was justified? Because I myself kind of hang in that balance of I'm not sure.
Yeah. Fact of the matter is that he pissed hot. The guy was taking a legal substance, a banned substance. He knew that he shouldn't have been taking it. And he got busted for it, so he got suspended. What I have a little bit of an issue with, and I know that it's not necessarily a part of the ruling, is that, he got busted for taking a banned substance, not to do with a fight, but to do during training. Now, he still has not pissed hot for a fight. So it's never been proven that Alistair has ever won a fight being on any sort of illegal substance. Whether you want to say, hey, obviously he was doing illegal substance because he got tested positive for it, okay. Yes, he did, but had it ever actually, in a fight, had he ever actually pissed hot for a fight result? He only ever pissed hot during training. So you can argue it however you want, but the fact of the matter is that, he got suspended and he's doing his time and, You know, Alistair's a good friend of mine. He'll come back bigger and stronger than ever. He'll come back clean. He's been training like a demon. We caught up just a few weeks ago. He was here in Vegas. He contacted me and asked me out for dinner. We went and caught up, and he was in great spirits. He's just itching to get back, to get that title off the Santos, which I think he will when he eventually gets the title shot. It might not be his first fight back. It might be the second one, but I don't see anyone in the heavyweight ranks at the moment that could, stand and trade with Alistair. I think that he will be the heavyweight champion of UFC in 2013.
Definitely, and I also agree with you on that. You know, kind of sticking to the subject of banned substances, what is your opinion on the state of testosterone replacement therapy within the sport, and do you think older fighters should be able to undergo TRT to help rejuvenate their careers?
Yeah, you know, it's a heated subject, and to me it's a little bit, you've already got, what's the allowance you have here in Nevada? You got like 6-1, is that correct?
I think so. It's either 6-1 or 4-1.
6-1. So basically you're allowed to take 6 times more testosterone than the average person as a competitive, fighter. So already you're allowing human beings, you're allowing athletes to push the norm 6 times further than it should be pushed. So when you allow this to happen, it opens up all sorts of cans of worms and all sorts of holes and doors that you can push and probe and make arguments for. But, you know, how do you counter that? Do you make it a 1-1 playing field? Do you keep it 6-1? You know, if you've got 6-1, do you make exceptions for people that maybe have freaking, less testosterone being produced or have one testicle? I don't know. You know, how do you... You've already granted 6 times the what is meant to be the normal human capacity for testosterone, so where do you sort of draw the line? Do you just sort of throw the door open and go, hey, you know what? Testosterone is senseless, and it's a level playing field if everyone can get their hands in it and do it. That's obviously a ridiculous way to do it, because then it comes to a matter of who's the better chemist, who can get their hands on the better stuff and get the stuff into them and be able to have it in their system and then get it out of their system. It's probably a subject that I should look into a lot more, but I sort of don't focus on it. To me, it's about the fighting, it's about the athletes, it's about the performances, it's about, making good television shows, and I try not to weigh myself down with, all the information of whose testosterone levels are this, whose testosterone levels are that. I just want to see guys fight. I just want to see good, clean, honest fights. I don't like to see a lot of the trash talk. I don't like to see, a lot of the bickering. I just want to see two guys get in the cage or get in the ring and give us an athletic endeavor that we can all appreciate.
Definitely, definitely. I'm actually on the same side as you. Both sides kind of feel flawed, because if you allow it, it becomes almost like Vitor Belfort said. It's a lot like Formula One, where the best engineers, not necessarily the best drivers or fighters in this case, win. But if you don't allow it, you're almost kind of siding on the line where, if you've done steroids, you shouldn't be able to compete again, because obviously those guys have lower levels of testosterone. One more question about the current state of MMA for you. Jones versus Sonnen, it's what everyone's been talking about the last couple weeks. I actually think filming for that season of The Ultimate Fighter started this past Monday. Everyone agrees the build-up's going to be absolutely amazing, but lots of people, including the likes of his former teammate Dan Henderson, Lyoto Machida, actually think it's bad for the sport. Do you agree with their sentiment, or do you think Sonnen deserves it, being the only one who stepped up to fight John Jones 8 days before UFC 151?
Look, The Ultimate Fighter is not rating anywhere near what it used to. The latest ratings, I think last week's episode or whatever, was somewhere around 650,000. It was the equal second lowest ratings for a long time. Just horrible ratings at the moment, just continue to decline. There are several reasons for that, I believe, is that the show has become very old. The formula has become very old. The contestants that are going into the house have become the same old. The same old repartee of what they say and what they do and how they act. A lot of the respect has gone from it and how they act. A lot of the martial arts spirit has gone from it, that they are just fighters coming in, not true martial artists that are coming in. And like I said, the formula has gotten very old. It's past its use-by date, and there's just too much of it. It's a thing that UFC does quite often is they overload, they overkill on events, on shows. And now you've got Charles Sonnen versus John Jones and eventually going to fight for the light heavyweight title. That's ridiculous. Charles Sonnen, how does he deserve a title shot? oh, he's going to deserve a title shot because he appears on a reality TV show. What does that say for the sport? You know, it's no longer about ranking, it's about ratings. And, you know, there's guys like Dan Henderson, Lyoto Machida, Glover Teixeira, guys that should be next in line to get that light heavyweight shot. But what, you know, you've got to go through a reality TV show now to get a crack at the UFC championship. In what other sport does this happen? You know, what other sport? UFC, you know, say they want to be the biggest sport in the world. They say they want to be on, you know, they want to be bigger than soccer. They want to be as big as the NFL. They want to be bigger than boxing. They want to be, you know, so big. But you're hatching championship fights out of a reality TV show. I don't know if boxing ever does that. I can't remember when boxing has done that. I can't remember when, you know, football's ever done that. Tennis has ever done that. What other sport has done that where a championship fight has been decided by participants on a reality TV show? It's ridiculous. Chael Sonnen comes off a loss at middleweight, goes on a reality TV show, and then gets a crack at the light heavyweight world championship. How does that compute? The only way it computes is because it's for the ratings, because the ratings are doing so poorly at the moment. You know, to me, it cheapens the title a lot, because a guy like Dan Henderson deserves that crack. A guy like Lyoto Machida deserves another crack at it. Guy like Glover Teixeira in maybe another two fights deserves a crack at it. Not a dude that just lost, just his ass handed to him at middleweight by Anderson Silva. Completely handed to him. And now, his next fight's going to be for the light heavyweight world championship, a division he hasn't fought in to take on the champion because he was on a reality show. It makes no sense. It only makes sense in the world of ratings. That's it.
Michael, I'm absolutely 100% agreed with you. We actually had a roundtable, I think, a week ago where I said the same thing you did. The UFC is teetering on the line. Do they want to be entertainment or do they want to be a sport? Because you need to let the fighters know how they need to go out there and perform in order to get that title shot. That's the goal. No fighter in the UFC just wants to fight. I mean, maybe there's a few of them, but most of them want that title shot. And if there's no well-defined path to the title, then you're cheapening the experience. And if you talk your way into a title shot, that's entertainment. And I completely agree with you, sir. Completely.
You know, and on that point you just said, and I agree with you, it's like there's no defined path to that title. There's no ranking system. You know, most other individual sports in the world have a distinct ranking system. Boxing's sanctioning bodies each have a ranking system. ATP, you know, the tennis tour has a ranking system. You know, UFC and is an individual sports organization, doesn't have a ranking system. So how do we know where fighters stand in terms of rankings? All the fights seem to be decided on the whim of a matchmaker and a promoter. And that's not how the sport should be run to gain that mainstream acceptance that it so desperately wants. And until it gets that acceptance, it's still only going to be even a niche sport, but even a major niche sport indeed. But it's only ever going to be relegated to that because, you know, at the end of the day, other organizations will turn around and go, hey, you just set up a championship match off a reality TV show. I mean, and the guy competing for it, the challenger, comes off a loss in another weight division. How do you possibly justify that? You know, where's the ranking system? How do fighters even know? How does someone like, you know, Wiedemann know when he's in line for a title shot? There's no ranking system. Is he the number one contender for that middleweight strap? You know, is Dan Henderson the number one contender? Is Lyoto number two? Is Teixeira number three? Well, now Chael Sonnen's number one, isn't he? And he's never even fought there before. I mean, there's no definable path, as you said. It's
madness.
Crazy.
Madness.
It is.
Yeah, we have one more question for you before we let you go. It's actually what we ask everyone as our last question. Chris Lieben likes bubblegum. Ian McCall likes Moose Tracks. John Anik is unfortunately lactose intolerant, which absolutely breaks my heart. But what is Michael Schiavello's favorite flavor of ice cream?
Favorite flavor of ice cream is a very good question. You guys have got some pretty good ice creams here in the States, I've got to admit. My favorite one at the moment would have to be, it's a Ben and Jerry's one. It's like caramel infused, so it's got like bits of caramel whipped through it and stuff. It's like vanilla caramel fudge sort of thing. Ben and Jerry's, I went and bought some at Whole Foods last week and I sat there in front of the TV and ate like half a tub in one night. It was beautiful. That's my favorite. My favorite at the moment, but I'd chop and change like the wind, man. It might be Pistachio next week. But at the moment, it's going to be that Ben and Jerry's flavor.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Thank you so much for joining us today, Michael. We really, really appreciate it. Any plugs or shout-outs before you go?
Just want to say a big thank you to you guys. You know, I know it's been a while. You guys have been trying to get me on, and my schedule just hasn't allowed for it. And it's nice to be able to sit back here and talk to you guys. You do a great job. It's very professional, really good questions, well thought out and well researched. And to everyone watching this weekend, we've got a stacked card on Friday night, RFA, for the very first time on national TV. It's got Tyson Griffin versus Efren Escudero, has got Marcio Cruz, has got Sergio Pettis, Chidi Njokuani on the card. That's here in Vegas. And then the night after, we've got the World Series of Fighting from Planet Hollywood. I'm doing the undercard that's streaming live on Sherdog. So join me Friday night on Access TV, Saturday night on the Sherdog prelims, and we're going to have a good weekend.
Thanks a million, man. We have really had a bunch of fun, and hopefully one day down the road we can get you back on and hear some more from you. Have a really great evening, man. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, bro. Happy Halloween. Take care.
You too.
See you guys.
Happy Halloween. Take care, buddy.